So welcome to another talk. Even when your retreat finishes, after Akatina, another retreat starts. They come on Sunday night and they carry on Monday. So another retreat, back to back. That's only a small number of people. So for those of you who are staying on a few more days, you get more talks, more chanting, more bad jokes. And as for me, more work. My motto, and everyone should have a motto, is no peace for the wicked. And if this is what it's like being good, I'd hate to be wicked. But you did ask, or someone said, I don't know if it came out to be a deep talk, but we were saying a few things in the last day about how do you know if somebody's enlightened, and somebody asked about do you need jhanas to be enlightened. So today's talk is on enlightenment. So at last you'll find out what it means to become enlightened. So you can get out if you don't want to go there. Because sometimes it's like, for many Buddhists, they're on this bus going towards enlightenment. At least that's what they think. They're not quite sure when you get there what it will be like and whether you really want to be there when you get there. So sometimes it's a bit scary. Yeah, we all want to get enlightened, but what does it mean? And I like telling the story from my youth of one of the reasons why I abandoned Christianity was, I know I was generally interested in all types of religions. And because, you know, through scholarships I went to a good school in West London, they had a chaplain at the school, you know, who's an Anglican priest. And so I wanted to ask him one day, in all sincerity, now, this idea of God, now what is God? Now, because I could never get my head around it. And then this priest, you know, I sat down with him, he said, well, you know, God is, you know, is ineffable, it's beyond words, it's in the beginning and end of all things. You know, it's the ground of all being. And he said all these things, the Alpha and Omega. And, you know, afterwards I said, well, but what is that? You know, is it some sort of Greek dictionary? Or what is it? And I could not get a straight answer. I couldn't get an answer which I could comprehend as maybe a 16, 17-year-old. It made no sense to me. And that's one of the reasons why I gave up Christianity, because you're trying to follow and believe something you just couldn't understand. And that made no sense to me. But then later on I got a lot of faith in Buddhism. It started to make sense to me until... Now, I asked a monk, I think it was in one of the Thai temples in London, I asked him, well, you know, this enlightenment, Nibbana, actually, you know, what is it? And he said, well, you know, it's beyond words. It's ineffable. It's the ground of all being. You know, it's the beginning and end of all things. And I think I've heard that before. And I realized that sometimes even monks really don't know what they're talking about, which means they can't explain it very well. And later on, I still had a lot of joy in meditation. There's much of Buddhism which I really liked and really could enjoy, so I never gave it up. But that was always one of those things in the background, the goal of Buddhism, Nibbana, what the heck was it? And can we get somebody, please, to describe it to me so an ordinary person can understand it? And later on, when I was at Cambridge University studying physics, I came across this incredible quote from one of the pioneers of quantum physics, you know, Werner Heisenberg. And everybody has the impression that quantum physics is just so difficult to understand. It's one of the most complex pieces of modern science. And only a few people with big brains could actually understand it. That was what most people assumed. But this fellow, Werner Heisenberg, who was one of the top quantum physicists, he came out and said, if you really understand quantum physics, if you really understand it, then you will be able to explain it to the lady who is serving you a glass of beer in the pub. You'll be able to explain it to an ordinary person. That is a measure of how much you understand it, your ability to explain it to others. And I thought, what a great sort of comment that was. And, you know, Nirvana is up there with quantum physics being so difficult to explain. But if you really know what you're talking about, you should be able to explain it. And of course, you know, now the challenge is, explain it, please. Because, you know, somebody told me, I mentioned that to you the other day, that many people, they try and look, you know, is that monk enlightened or not? And they say the standard was whether you put jam on your toast. So this morning I didn't put any jam or marmalade on my pancakes. That doesn't mean anything. So the best description about enlightenment is one which everybody understands. And even you tell this to children, 11, 12-year-old kids at the school which you teach children of Buddhists. You teach this to them and they get it straight away. I'm sure you've heard it before because it's in the Happiness Through Meditation book. But I'm going to start from this to give you an idea of what enlightenment is and how it's achieved. Once you know what it is, then you've got an idea of why this type of meditation I'm teaching here makes sense. And that is the old story of the five children playing wishing game. And those five children playing the wishing game had these rules. Every child had a wish, and the child who came up with the best wish, as judged by everybody, would win the wishing game. And so the child who went first thought for a few seconds and said, if I had a wish, I would wish for a new, I think it's called Xbox, like a computer game program. Because you like playing, is that right, Xbox, computer games? I've never played a computer game in my life, so I don't know. But a computer game, gizmo, because you like playing computer games, and that was fair enough. And the second kid, because you have more time to understand, the second child said, no, if I had a wish, I would wish for a computer game shop. Because if I owned a shop, I could get not just one computer gizmo. When the next ones came out, because I owned the shop, I could get that one too. So having a computer game shop was obviously more superior. And this is one of the reasons why, if ever you're in a debate or having a conversation with somebody, always be the second or the third one to answer, not the first, because you're always at a great disadvantage. It reminded me of the story of the Buddhist monk, the Catholic priest, and the Jewish rabbi, who were doing some interfaith work, you know, in Singapore, you know, trying to get the communities together. And they, first of all, they would just meet for a cup of tea and discuss. And then instead they decided to meet for lunch, you know, to have, you know, more time together. And then they decided that that was not enough to really get to know each other and become friends, because until you really become friends and trust each other, it's very hard to exchange your views in an open and unafraid way. So they decided to play some games together, you know, just to get some binding between them two, you know, to bond together. And they decided the easiest game to play was a game of cards, and one thing led to another, and soon they were right in there gambling, you know, for money, really getting into it. And that was illegal outside of the casino. And so somebody saw them, called the police, and the three of them got arrested and had to face court on a charge of illegal gambling. And the Jewish rabbi was the Christian priest was the first interviewed by the judge. And the judge said, look, you know, you're all holy people, so I'm not going to mess around. I'm just going to ask you directly, you know, priest, were you gambling? And very quickly, you know, so quickly the judge couldn't see it, he said, God forgive me. No, he said. He lied. And the next was a Jewish rabbi. And the judge asked him the same question, were you lying? And he did the old trick, which I used to do in school, or people said you're supposed to do in school, is crossing your fingers behind the back. But somehow or other, when you were a little school kid, that meant that, you know, the lie didn't matter. So the Jew put his fingers behind his back and said, no, I wasn't gambling. And so the third was a Buddhist monk. And this was in Singapore. Judges know Buddhist monks in Singapore. And he said, no, you keep five precepts, even more than that. And I know you don't lie, so please, were you gambling? And the Buddhist monk replied, with whom, Your Venerable? which is why it's always best to be the last to answer the questions. So anyway, the second kid said he wanted a video game store. Great, that's a more superior wish. The third kid, you know, he had, again, more chance to listen, so he could get a much better wish than that. He thought this was the wish which was going to win. So he said, if I had a wish, I would wish for $100 billion US. Because that's more money than anyone can spend in a lifetime, except for the government of the United States. But a human being can't spend that much. So it was like an unlimited supply of money, basically. And obviously that was a much superior wish. And there were two children left. And they had to try and beat that 100 billion unlimited amount of money. And don't say 200 billion or 300 billion, because, you know, that's basically the same. It's more money than you can ever spend. So the fourth kid, she was very smart, and she said, if I had a wish, my wish would be for three wishes. That's a wish. And for my first wish, I'll have the computer game store. For my second wish, I'll have $100 billion US, just like the other two. And for my third wish, I'll have three more wishes. That way I can go on forever. And how can you beat that? An unlimited number of wishes always granted. And the fifth kid, the last kid, as many of you know in the story, clearly won the wishing game. Because they said, if I had a wish I was so content I never needed any wishes ever again. That won the wishing game. Contentment is always higher than having a wish, even one granted. And that last kid was the Buddha in this story. And that's a very lovely story because it shows that sometimes when we aspire for unlimited wealth, which is kid number three, or unlimited power, which is why many people go into politics. They've got enough money, but they still can't get what they want. So they try and go into politics so that whatever they wish, even if they can't buy it, they can get. The unlimited wish is granted. And sometimes if you feel like, if you ever read the descriptions of the Pure Land, in the Pure Land, whatever you wish, whatever you think, is there right away for you. If you think of your favorite food, you don't have to wait till 11 o'clock. It's just there. If your favorite music, it just arrives. Whatever you want, it's just there straight away. But even better than that is the contentment when all wishes have disappeared and you're totally content. That is called Nibbana, enlightenment, the end of all wishing. Third Noble Truth, the end of craving, is enlightenment. Now you've got something, you can understand what enlightenment is. And now you maybe understand why I've been telling you in your meditation, stop wanting the nimitta. Stop trying to get somewhere. Don't try to let go, but let go of trying. The end of craving, no wishing, content, happy to be here. That is a taste of enlightenment, where there's not a craving in your mind for hour after hour, which is why the only time you are that still, because the opposite of craving is stillness. The opposite of stillness is wanting something. I'm talking about in your head, in your mind. That eventually you let go so much, you're so still, you enter one of these jhanas. And in these jhanas, you are aware, but there's no wanting left. As I mentioned yesterday, especially the second jhana, there's no will left at all. There's nothing to do, any wanting. Craving has finished for a while. And that's one of the reasons why the Buddha said that the jhanas are the happiness of Nibbana. Sambodhi, which means enlightenment, sukha. It's a taste. The taste of the happiness of Nibbana. So content, so free, so still, so at peace. Craving desire stopped for a little while. Ah, this is nice. The jhanas are only temporary, but at least they give you a window to be able to understand what this Nibbana is all about. And it puts so many other things into perspective about Buddhism. You know why Buddhism isn't so materialistic? At least it's not supposed to be. You know, we're not into having so many cravings and desires. We're into peace and contentment and happiness. You know, that not through getting things, but through appreciation, through the gratitude for how much you've already achieved, how far you've already come. Being grateful for all the meditation you've got so far. Being grateful for that, not thinking, oh, it's not good enough, I should have done better. That is not Buddhism. We call that spiritual materialism. Always wanting another achievement, another attainment to show off to your friends when you go back, like another bangle, you know, which you wear on your body. These aren't bangles. These are just letting goes. You notice monks don't wear any bangles. We don't have any. I've heard the new word bling. We're bling-free monks. But what we do have is peace and contentment because you lessen your cravings and desires. And that is, the more you lessen your cravings and desires, the more still you are, the closer you are to enlightenment. But you know how difficult it is to let go. Many of you keep on saying that's the biggest problem. Yeah, we know we're supposed to let go, but how the heck do we do this? Ajahn Brahm, can you please give me a letting go pill or something? So I can just take it once and then I let go and then, you know, I don't have to work so hard. Wouldn't it be nice if you could do that? So, no, there is no letting go pill. Well, my job as a teacher is to keep getting you in that area, keep making suggestions, basically getting in your head and brainwashing you until one day, someplace, sometime, you know, maybe just a lot of time it's because of frustration. You try and getting nowhere and just, oh, what the heck, I can't get this. And you give up, you let go, you surrender. And it's amazing, sometimes those are the moments when people really do let go of craving and trying to attain something. And they get these amazing experiences. Those are the times when you stop, like the donkey stopped. I usually like to tell this story about the last day of a 9-day retreat, but I also make sure that our caretaker locks the doors of all of the storerooms so you can't get hold of any rope. This is a true story. It's in the Terigata, the verses of the enlightened nuns in the time of the Buddha. And there was this woman, she became a bhikkhuni. And for 7 years she was meditating, not just for 9 days, for 7 long years, really getting into it. And she said after 7 years she hadn't had a moment of peace. Always mind wandering, falling asleep. Now many of you have done much better than that bhikkhuni. You have had moments of peace. But this woman, she was a bhikkhuni and still not a moment of peace for 7 long years. Imagine that. And because 7 years went past, she thought, there's no chance for me. There must be something wrong with me, some bad karma or something. I just cannot meditate. So she did not want to go back to the household life. And she could not stay as a bhikkhuni because she could not meditate. So there was only one choice for her. She took a length of rope. She went into the forest. She climbed up to a branch of a tree, tied one end of the rope to the tree and the other one around her neck. And she was just about within a second of jumping off when her mind became still. She'd let go. At last. That was a close one. Which is why we don't recommend it. But why did that happen? Now look at the very famous story of Ananda. Ananda, the Buddha's attendant. He had the best teacher in the universe. He had 25 years following the Buddha, listening to all his teachings, being close to some of the greatest monks with psychic powers and everything. And after 25 years, when the Buddha passed away, Ananda? Nothing. Still, he couldn't meditate either. Still was hopeless. You can imagine that 25 years, not just 9 days, 25 years with the Buddha being the closest friend and still wasn't enlightened. Imagine how depressing that would be. And what got worse was when they decided to have a big meeting of all the famous senior monks to try and gather all the teachings together. So they decided to have a meeting of 500 because, you know, there's so many monks, you can't have everybody. And so 500. And they chose 499 who were all fully enlightened with psychic powers. And the 500th was Ananda. And they only invited him because, you know, he knew so much. He'd been with the Buddha for such a long time. So the following morning, he was going to have a meeting among 500 people, and he was the only one, just the one out of 500 who was still stupid. And everybody knew that. It's exactly the same as if I make an announcement tomorrow just before the retreat ends. I say, you've all done very well. You've all had jhanas except this girl. How would you feel? Oh, that sucks, that's not fair. Oh. And that's only one out of 60. Imagine one out of 500 and you're the only stupid person there. So poor Ananda, he said, okay, I'm not going to sleep the night before. And he really went for it. He meditated all night, put in a lot of effort. When the dawn came up, was he enlightened? Not at all. Still as stupid, still as far away as ever. So what did he do? I'm not going to get anywhere now. There's still another hour before the meeting. I'm going to take a nap. And so he went to his room, and they say before his head hit the pillow, he became fully enlightened with all the psychic powers. As soon as he let go of trying. Do you get it? He'd been like that donkey chasing after enlightenment all night for 25 years beforehand. Chasing. And enlightenment, even though he had the greatest teacher, was still 2 feet in front. And then he gave up. I'm not going to get this. I'm hopeless. And as soon as he stopped trying, enlightenment came to him very quickly. And the nice part of the story was, you know, just... It's nice when you give stories a bit of razzmatazz because, you know, because he just got enlightened, you know, he's blissed out for a little while, he came late to the meeting. So when they had the meeting, they'd locked the doors. 499 were in there and Ananda was outside. So, just to show off, to make sure that everybody knew that he was really enlightened, he entered the hall by going through the keyhole. And that was so awesome, they realized, oh, Ananda's got it. So they welcomed him in. So that's how he celebrated his enlightenment, by entering the building through the keyhole. So, if any of you get enlightened tonight, I don't expect to see you coming through the doors, but no, through the keyhole. That's how you know that someone's enlightened. Nothing to do with putting jam on your toast or pancakes. Coming through the keyhole, that's cool. So ever since that time, that's one of the other reasons why I've been telling you in this retreat, if you ever feel tired, take a rest. It's called the Ananda method of enlightenment. The more times you hit the pillow, the more probability there is that it might happen for you. But it shows you what's happening there. Those two cases of letting go. One, this nun out of desperation, totally gave up, ever thinking she'd ever get enlightened. Another Ananda, who also just totally let go. Isn't that pointing out something to you? The problem is, you're striving, you're craving too much. Even striving, you're craving for good things. When you let go, meditation is so easy. As I said, Ajahn Brahm can't meditate. I have to disappear. Because the reason why we crave, the cause of these things is me. This thing called I and a self. Which is one of the sayings of the Buddha. Where there's a sense of self, there'll be some craving and controlling. When there's no self, all the craving and controlling disappears. This was one of what I thought was my simile. Because when you start to understand these principles, as I mentioned yesterday, sometimes you can't find words for them. And you can't find similes for them because this is something very internal, very sort of personal. And you find, what is this craving business? And how can we describe letting go and the relationship between a self and a craving? And I developed this simile of the hand. Because I noticed the way I use my hand, you're always moving it. And you're always picking things up. So I pick things up. Stop it. Put it down. You just watch. In a few minutes, I'll pick something else up. And it's not my problem. This is just what a hand does. It picks things up. Because I noticed this when I became a monk. The biggest thing you give up when you become a young monk is sex. Boys give up girls. Girls give up boys when they become nuns. I know that's a tough thing to do when you're only 23. So, I gave up girls. I can let that go. And even though I said the food was really terrible, you really got into food after a while. One craving had been suppressed and another one came up. So let go of food. And then something else came up, like sugar. And put heaps and heaps of sugar in your tea. Now stop that. And then something else came up. Have you ever noticed when you let go of one thing, another thing comes up to take its place? There was an endless. And I realized one day the only way for my hand to stop picking things up is to cut off the hand. And when I have no hand, only then will it won't pick up things, because it's the nature of the hand to pick things up. Exactly the same. The only way you stop craving for good is to cut off this self, this idea of who you think you are. Only then will craving stop. Which is why the key part of stopping craving and being still. Meditation suppresses craving, gives you some stillness and peace for a short time to give you a taste and also an understanding of what's going on. But then eventually, when you see there's no one in here, then the craving stops. That's really the only way. That's why non-self is fundamental. It's fundamental to letting go. Seeing there's no one in here. That's why I alluded to that yesterday, I think, or the day before, when I said a great little technique is learning when you go home to be a visitor, not always an owner, in your own apartment. And then you don't have so much sense of wanting to control and do all these jobs. You're only a visitor, it's none of your business. It gives you a taste of what non-self is. It's not mine, it's not my duty. So for me, that was cutting off the hand, cutting off the sense of self. And I really thought that was my simile, and I was very proud of it, because it was very evocative, and I taught it to many people for a couple of years, until someone pointed out in the Samyutta Nikaya the simile of the hand by the Buddha. almost exactly the same. And you know, that I hadn't read that, not in this lifetime. And that's really spooky sometimes, you know, when you make up a simile and you haven't read that book before and you find out it's exactly the same. That gives you goosebumps. But put that one aside, it's a great simile. As long as there's a sense of self in here, you'll be controlling and doing things. And the more you control and do, that builds up the sense of who you think you are. Which is one of the reasons why people get afraid of getting old. Because you find, you know, you are not in control anymore. You literally have to get somebody else to clean your bottom after you've gone to the toilet. And for many people, that is just so hard to take, so embarrassing, so demeaning. Why? For me, when that happens, it's not my bottom. I'm only visiting here, so you clean it up for me. I've been helping all of you so many years. Already that people rush to open the door for me. Maybe when I'm old, there'll be a whole line of people wanting to clean my bottom for me. To make merit. But why are people afraid of that dementia? And it's simply because that they think that that's who they are. They are the one in control. You know, I visited, my mother had dementia for 3 years before she passed away, before she died. And one charming occurrence when I went to visit her in the Institute for People with Dementia, it was a charming experience. It wasn't all bad and fearful, because when I went into the locked ward with my brother, you know, there was my mother standing, and my brother said, "That's not her dress." Because my brother was looking after, you know, all the clothes business. "That's not her dress." And said, "Oh yeah, that always happens." Because these were a group of women, and because they couldn't remember anything, they had absolutely zero sense of ownership. So they go in each other's room, if they saw a nice dress, they just put it on. Other women would wear my mum's dress, she'd wear other people's dress. Wasn't that enlightened? Wouldn't it be wonderful? You can go into other people's cottages, if you see a pair of trousers you like, just wear it. We share, we've got no sense of ownership. You go outside afterwards, if you like that pair of shoes, you don't fancy yours. You know that happens. I don't know if it happens in the Buddhist fellowship. It did happen in our Buddhist society in West Australia once. People got this idea, they'd come in the worst possible shoes they had. And they go back with the best. But even more, you can't beat true stories. Even worse, at our Buddhist center, that people were always complaining that just only one shoe was missing. You know, they'd have their left shoe there, but not the right one. And no, we really thought there was like a one-legged thief who was stealing just one. We couldn't work out what was happening. Now, if you're going to steal a shoe, why just steal one shoe? And it was really lost. You know, we searched around everywhere, and you know, there was only one shoe left, and one shoe was missing, so the person had to go home with one shoe. But finally, the mystery was solved when the neighbor had a dog and was cleaning up the dog house and the little kennel, and the kennel was full of shoes. This dog would go, when I was giving a talk or someone was giving a talk, go outside and sniff the one, you know, with the best smell, and took it and stored it in the kennel. And of course, no one could find it. It was a dog. It wasn't a one-legged person. It was a four-legged one stealing all the shoes. That's a true story. But anyway, so when we can let go, you know, of even ownership. Now that is a sign that you're letting go of this thing called my sense of self. Could you ask who you are? I have great fun being a monk in a country like Australia, because on many records I don't exist. Because every now and again we have this problem as monks. You know, we have to get a passport. We know how to have identification. And to have identification, well, usually the first thing they ask for is your driver's license. And monks don't drive, so we have not got driver's license. Okay, your credit card. No, haven't got one of those either. You know, there's very few people don't have credit cards in this world. You know, monks are one of those. It gets us into trouble often. And so the next one, because sometimes you get me into hotels. You know, sometimes that, you know, that I am traveling somewhere, even in Singapore, Beta put me up in a hotel one night because she wanted to make some merit. If she wasn't there, because I've checked into a hotel before because I'm going to some conference, and I check in there and they write down your name, can have your credit card details. I say, I don't have a credit card. You can't check in then. Because, you know, they need a credit card in case you trash the room or drink all the alcohol from the from the minibar and don't tell them. So look, and I don't drink, you know, I won't take anything from the minibar, and I'm well behaved, I won't trash anything. I'll probably even not sleep on the floor, I sleep on the bed, I'll probably sleep on the floor. And they said, no, we need a credit card. And a few times someone has come and saved me. You know, one of the organizers, what's the problem? I need a credit card number. And they put their credit card. If you haven't got a credit card, sometimes you just, you know, you don't exist. So what else can you have? Bank account details? No. You know, some other things they ask for is like a marriage certificate. I ain't got one of those, right? Tax file number. In Australia, you have tax file numbers, which is one of the key sources of identification. No, we don't. We don't pay tax. We don't make any money. So we don't exist there either. And in so many registers which make, you know, you exist in a country like Australia, you just are invisible. You do not exist at all. Which is amazing. You know, if ever I got murdered and killed and they tried to identify me, they wouldn't know who the heck I was. Isn't that wonderful? You don't exist. His emptiness, Ajahn Brahm, or whatever it is. Now, all of those indicators of what the government takes you to be. It's what you do. You're a doctor, a housewife, an accountant, or what you own. You know, your car, your apartment. That is actually what defines you. And it's interesting, that's also what happens. You know, who you think you are. And that also gives you a lot of pride as well. There was this story, it's in the new volume of Open the Door of Your Heart, for those who have read it already, about this guy goes to a party, and you know, they introduce each other, you know, and what do you do? And he said, he asked this young lady, he said, what do you do? And he said, I'm a GP. And this guy comes, you know, who's asked the question, said, only a GP? He said, that's nothing, I'm a brain surgeon. Now, being a GP, I mean, that's just ordinary, but being a brain surgeon, that's really impressive. He said, you know, looking really proud. And he asked the host wife, what do you do? And she said, I'm a doctor too. I work for Médecins Sans Frontières. I go to all of these very dangerous places and I do medical care for the worst possible cases where there's no other medical care at all. And the brain surgeon said, that's so wonderful what you do. But that's hardly brain surgery, is it? And then the host's son introduced himself and he said, now what do you do? This brain surgeon said to the son. And he said, I work for NASA. And you're a brain surgeon. Brain surgery is not rocket science, is it? That's pride again. We always think, I'm a brain surgeon. And there's always someone better than you, which puts you in your place, which is a good thing. But you can see that's where the sense of self comes from, who you think you are. And it's all because of what you do. Imagine you did nothing. You had no job. No, you had no career. You had no money. Would you exist? Imagine you sat in a cave for 6 months. Doing absolutely nothing, would you exist? It's wonderful to see what happens. The least you do, the more you vanish, and you just meld in with everything. You're not separate anymore. When you do something, you're separating yourself. You have a goal. You're separating where you are now from where you want to be. When you do nothing, you're content and happy to be here. Where you are is where you want to be. You're at peace. You vanish. That's one of the scariest things about enlightenment. That's one of the reasons why someone like Sun Han couldn't sleep at night. Simply because he realized he would have to vanish. Everything he ever thought he was, a man, Singaporean, a lawyer, that would all have to vanish. That's not what he really was. How many women are there in this room? None. How many men? None. How many Singaporeans? None. How many Ang Mos? None. There's no one here. Oh, what joy. You all just happen to be in this woman's body this lifetime. Next time you may have a man's body. Men might have women's body. Isn't that wonderful? That's the only way women can understand men and men can understand women. To swap bodies. The trouble is that when we learn what it's like to be a woman and become a man in the next life, we tend to forget. Wouldn't it be wonderful if we could actually swap even in this lifetime? Yeah. It'd be great, wouldn't it? So, you know, your husband and wife sitting together and I do some magic chant, zap, 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 zap. And he goes into his wife's body and his wife goes into his man's body. Now, this would be a good movie in that. And so they can swap and they can find out what it's like to be a woman. And he can find out what it's like to be a guy. And then afterwards you'll be able to understand each other for a change. Get the kids, you know, to suddenly go into dad's body and dad to become a kid again. Actually, they don't need to do that. They're probably already kids. But just to change. To get some idea that this is not really who you are. This is just a role you happen to be playing in this lifetime. And then when we don't identify with these things, we don't become them, we have much more peace and wisdom in life. So, when you stop doing things, you vanish. And that is the scariest thing of all. Your idea of identity, who you think you are, being taken away from you. It's scary, but it's so liberating. Me, Ajahn Brahm, who the heck am I? I have so many different roles in life. And I love telling the anecdote of being over the road in Bodhinyana Monastery one day, and even now I'm over 60 and a well-known monk, I still like getting myself dirty whenever there's any building project. Even just last year, we were putting a concrete ceiling on one of the monks' huts, and the only way to do that is, you know, we got the concrete truck. You can ask the monks, this was true, putting the concrete in the wheelbarrow and pushing it up a ramp up to the roof, which is, you know, takes a bit of strength. So, you know, I said, I'm having a go at this. And so I got hold of a wheelbarrow and also pushed it up. It was really great fun, you know, boys being boys. Sometimes you think, you know, I'm fat, but this is all muscle. You doubt it. No, it's not, I agree. But I'm still, well, very strong and very fit, you'd be surprised. And I asked the monks, pushing wheelbarrows up a slope. And, you know, you get all dirty and you have great fun, now, boys being boys. Because some of the worst part, you know, of being a monk, sitting there having your photograph taken, signing a book, sitting in a photograph, taking a book. You know, okay, you can be the celebrity, but it's nice that just, you know, messing around and being a labourer sometimes. So a few years ago, I was also doing the same thing. And you get yourself really mucky, you know, with cement stains all over you, really dirty and sweaty and things, you know, all hanging off. And, you know, went to go have a shower before the lunch. And as I was walking, it was actually just in front of the meditation hall, I was going to my room for a shower. I passed this Sri Lankan girl. Now, a woman, actually, because she's maybe about 40 or 50. She was wearing a very expensive sari, and you wouldn't believe how many bangles she had around her. You know, I told the monks afterwards, I called her ice cream truck, because you could hear her tinkle about a kilometre away with all the bangles, tinkle, 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 ice cream truck. And she asked me, said, where is Ajahn Brahm? She never recognized me. And sometimes just for being cheeky, but also just, you know, as an interesting experiment. You know, I said, oh, well, if you go over to where the dining hall is, over there, he'd probably be there in about 5 or 10 minutes. He said, oh, thank you very much. And I went off, had a shower, cleaned myself up, changed my robes, and I went into the dining hall and talked to her. And I talked to her about 1/4 hour. And afterwards she said, that's very wonderful, you're a great monk, and this is a very beautiful monastery, I'm so inspired to come here. You know, because I'm actually very well known in Sri Lanka. And at the end of it, she said, but if you don't mind me saying, there's one thing wrong, because as I was coming here, I saw one of your monks, and he was dirty and very badly dressed. You know, it's not right, it's inappropriate for monks to be dressed like that and be so dirty. And I said, oh really, madam? I will talk to him later. And I can't lie, I often talk to myself. But I enjoyed that because 1 minute I could be a dirty labourer and just a really sloppy monk. And the next minute, just be the great Ajahn Brahm, and none of them are me, which is wonderful. So, you know, sometimes you go to airports in countries which don't know Buddhism, and you get the dog sniffing you, come over here, sir, and they think you're a drug trafficker. Or in Australia, you know, they look at you dressed like this and say, hey, why are you dressed like a girl? You're a deviant. So it's great we can be all sorts of different things when you have no self. So that's one of the nicest things. When you have no self, you don't try and control other people, nor do you try and control your environment. You can really let go. When there's a sense of self, you have what you own, what you possess, who you think you are. And you'll try and protect that. Even your life force. If you think that you are this body, when you start to get old, you'll try and protect this thing which is so precious to you. All fear is when something which you're attached to, something which you identify with, is about to be taken away. When you realize you don't own this body, it's not yours, you can let it go easily. It's nothing to do with me, it's just a body, that's all. Can you also let go of your mind? Your mind has got nothing to do with it. You don't own it. That's why you can get dementia. If you get dementia, wonderful, I can wear other people's clothes. For those of you who like living in the present moment, dementia is wonderful. You can't remember anything, and you've got no fear for the future. It's almost like jhana. Well, not quite, but... I've noticed with people with dementia, most of them are very happy. The people who suffer are the relations and friends. They're the ones who suffer from dementia, not the people actually who have it. Isn't that so? So, you know, don't be afraid. You don't own this mind anyway or brain, so just let it go. If someone wants to take it, fine. Can you do that? Now, little by little, we're learning how to let go and to overcome that fear. Every stage of meditation, when you come to a barrier, you're afraid to go further, those are the cutting edge of insight moments. That is where insight happens. Not afterwards when you're contemplating this and contemplating that. That's just thinking. You come across a barrier. Why can't you go further? Why can't you let go? Because you are attached to something. That's where the fear comes up, letting go of something you're attached to. Which is why when people come up and say, I've got this big fear in meditation, I say very good and I mean it for once. This is very good, this is excellent. You are facing one of your deep core attachments. And if you could just go over that barrier, you've let go of something really important. The thing which stops you being enlightened. So whenever you get that fear, please be excited as well. This is great stuff. You're coming across attachment, and if you can pass that test and just go a bit deeper into stillness, into freedom, you've let go of something really important. Whether it's your attachment to your body, whether it's attachment to your will, whether it's attachment to your thinking, whatever it is, if it's fear, that's a sign of attachment about to disappear. Go for it. And then, when you do actually have to let go of everything, when you die or you get old, it's not a problem at all. You've trained to let go of those attachments in your meditation. And the proof of the pudding is that when someone says, your cancer is terminal, you're going to die, you can be someone like Dr. K. Sri Dhammananda, who, when he was told that his cancer was terminal, there's nothing more that could be done, he's going to die in 3 months, broke out in laughter. That's my monk. So, you know, you're going to die anyway. Why not laugh? And I remember seeing the doctor. I mean, people told me about that, but his doctor, because I go to Malaysia a lot, I saw him and he said, yep, absolutely true. This is the only person I've ever, you know, told was going to die of cancer who just laughed. Most people cry, oh, why me? I'm too young to die. This is a true story. Apparently I read this in a Buddhist magazine from the United States. It was a lady, 96 years of age. 96. She'd been healthy all her life. And when she went to a checkup and the doctor found a cancer inside of her at 96, the first thing which was ever sick with her, she complained, why me? My goodness, you've got away with it for so long. What do you mean, why me? But we all think that, don't we? Why me? You know the answer to why me? Why not? So there was a guy, you know, he's willing to let go. So he just laughed when he told he was terminal. That was a good sign that, you know, he wasn't attached to his body on this life. You know, that was actually quite impressive. So could you do that? That's a sign that you've overcome attachments to this body. When people say you're going to get demented, you're going to be totally out of control. If you've got no fear at all, it means, you know, you understand this world doesn't belong to you anyway. So you won't be afraid. Fine, doesn't matter. What about that person? The doctor told him, he said, there's two bad things wrong with you. First of all, you know, you have cancer and it's terminal. He said, oh, that's terrible. What's the second thing wrong with me? He said, you've got dementia too. He said, well, that's okay, at least I haven't got cancer. So there's many advantages having dementia. So, so this is what enlightenment is. It's basically sort of facing all your attachments, and attachments and the sense of self, they go together. It's the sense of self which picks up things, which attaches to them. That's what the sense of self is. What tries to own things and won't let them go? What will try to hold this body and just doesn't want it to get old and die? Why some people dye their hair when they're getting old? Come on! It's nice to have, you know, old hair. You get much more respect in Asian societies when you're old. Is that still the case? No. Well, instead of dyeing your hair, shave your hair. That's even better. Says a lot about it. So that is a sense that when you can you see the sense of self, attachment, craving, those two go together. So when the sense of self disappears, or when attachment disappears, the sense of self disappears. Which is why when you let go in meditation, you feel you're disappearing. This thing you think you are, this person who you've known for such a long time, you know, whatever that name is, it's Claire or Peter or Jocelyn, whatever. That disappears. At first that's scary because you're attached to that. Let it go and become so freeing. Have you all read that little book, No Ajahn Chah? No Ajahn Brahm, no Claire, no Beta, no lunch. I've gone too far, haven't I? That's how we let go of things. And when we let go of that, the more the sense of self is diminished, the closer we are to enlightenment. So it is a disappearing. And you can, I think, pretty easily understand that. You may have not experienced that, but you've experienced some of it, even a tiny bit of it, even on this meditation retreat, just seeing your hands disappear and seeing how weird and sometimes scary that might be. To be in a dark room where you can't see anything, you've got your eyes closed, or sometimes your hearing just turns off, and you're totally vulnerable. Anything could happen, but you feel okay, you've letting go. Every time you let go, you are countering an attachment, getting closer to non-self, and this path of meditation going into the jhanas just is, shows you that. And the nicest thing is, the deeper you go in meditation, the more blissful it is. Which shows you, the more you let go of the sense of self, the more happy you are. The bigger your ego, the more you own, the more you suffer. I've seen many, many wealthy people. I've yet to see a wealthy person as happy. I'm being honest with you. The very wealthy people I've seen, some very mega rich people, you know, that you are much happier than they are, by far. Me, I am mega poor. I've got no savings. I've got no investment for my old age. I've got no property. I've got, if our Buddhist society decides to kick me out because they don't like how I teach, then I'm just homeless. I've got absolutely no security whatsoever. Isn't that wonderful? Totally insecure, free as a bird. Is that scary? It's not, because you feel so free. You are owned by possessions, you don't possess them. You all know that. You don't own your house. Your house owns you. Isn't it wonderful just to be so free? That takes a lot of courage. You're letting go of stuff. Very wealthy people, they have a lot of suffering. I'm not telling you to give away all your money, but don't worry about it too much. Have a moderate house, a moderate car, moderate savings, but don't think that that's the most important thing in life. You know, that's just, you know, just having enough food to eat. Remember, just the happiness in your heart, the less you own, the less you attach to, the more happy you feel. And this is what you experience in the meditation. The more you let go, the more you bliss out. And it's incredible bliss. Much more than you'd ever think. There was this one guy staying here just, I think last year. He was a heroin addict. And he was, you know, trying to sort of get off the substance abuse. He'd done, you know, the worst part of it, and then he came here. But unfortunately, that once you get stuck into that drug addiction, it really is so tough, you know, to give it up. He went back again to it. This is really so sad. But before then, I remember he came up to me, he just had a breakthrough in meditation. You know, he had not a jhana, but very close to it. And I remember him running up to me as I was working up to my heart and saying, Ajahn Brahm, I've got to tell you this. Now, you've kept on saying that, you know, this bliss of meditation is better than sex. He said, no, that is wrong, Ajahn Brahm. It's much, much better than that. Because, you know, the high which I get from heroin, this is from a heroin addict. I can't say this, and hopefully none of you can say this, because you've never taken that terrible stuff. But he said the high from heroin is much, much better than sex. He said, I thought I'd never say this, but meditation is even better than heroin, way better. You know, so it's, you know, on the levels you get sex, very best sex, I mean not ordinary sex, very best. Heroin is much higher, so he says. And then way above that is meditation. Now isn't that sort of saying something? That gives you insight into what real happiness is from an experience. When you really let go, when you disappear, you have to disappear. You can't do jhanas. You vanish. The more you vanish, the less you do things, the more these jhanas happen. That's why they're called a taste of enlightenment, a taste of bliss, way beyond what you ever thought possible. So now you know what enlightenment is. It's powerful, it is deep, but you can understand it. I know that some traditions, they say these incredible sayings, and people say, wow, that was deep. And I ask them, why do you think it was deep? Because we couldn't understand it. That's why it was deep. And sometimes people criticize me. They say, Ajahn Brahm, we can understand what he says. It can't be deep. Please don't get into that. You know, these are some of the deepest teachings. But, you know, I can make them understandable, comprehensible to people. And don't go thinking that some people say gobbledygook and you don't understand a word of it, but it must be deep. That is stupid, people. So Werner Heisenberg, if you know what you're talking about, you can explain it and people understand. So that is what enlightenment is. And now you know why we meditate this way. Why to ask people, don't put too much effort in. You're just strengthening the cause of the problem. You get more craving. And you find, if people go to those meditation retreats where you're asked to put forth effort, to sit for 2 hours, sit for 3 hours, sit for 4 hours, sit for all night, don't move. If you go to those types of meditation retreats, you find you come out with more ego attachments and anger manifests very easily. Now you know why. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Hope you enjoyed the talk. Now we have some interviews. And for those of you who are getting frustrated, please do not take the rope. But you can try the Ananda method. Ananda method is pretty safe. Try and have a nap.